morning, everyone. We're about to start the seminar, which is called Caveats. Note the interest, beware the traps. I hope everyone's received a folder which should contain the relevant sections of the Transfer of Land Act, and you may find that useful for the purpose of this morning's discussion. Caveats is a very interesting topic. At some time in your professional life, whether as a barrister or a solicitor, you will come across the administrative injunction that is called a caveat, and which is created under the Transfer of Land Act. What is necessary to appreciate is that a caveat is purely a creature of statute, created, as I said, under the Transfer of Land Act, and it was created as part of a scheme which recognised the need to have some safeguard because of the indefeasibility of title principle. So a registered proprietor, once registered on title, has an interest which is paramount to all others. So the purpose of the caveat was really to make sure that you could prevent registrations from proceeding. And as you will see this morning, it has not always been used in that way. We will be talking this morning about how the caveat procedure, which is really a self-help procedure in many ways, has been the subject of abuse, at least for as long as I can remember. Really, the caveat is the typical situation with the caveat is intended to address is where you have a contract of sale, a transfer of land document which has not yet been registered, and you lodge a caveat to make sure that your interest is protected pending registration. But often the caveat procedure is abused, and I might just refer to one example in my own experience, one recent example. I'm a co-owner of property, and a person alleged against one of the other co-owners that they owed a debt. Proceedings had not yet been issued, and what that person did was lodge a caveat. So when that happens, as you'll find out this morning, there are two avenues to remove the caveat. One is under Section 89A, which is a self-help procedure, and the other is under Section 90 to issue proceedings. What I did in this case is that we did the 89A procedure, which involves the Registrar of Titles sending a document to the caveator saying that unless you issue proceedings within 30 days, your caveat will lapse. What happened and what we suspected would happen in this case is that the person didn't issue proceedings and the caveat did lapse. But, of course, the owners of the property incurred the costs of having that caveat removed, of having set in process the administrative procedure. And, unfortunately, one of the loopholes in the Act is that while the Registrar of Titles can assist in the grant of a caveat, he does not have power to order costs. And the only way that you can seek costs is to issue proceedings and go through the compensation provisions provided by Section 118 of the Transfer of Land Act. So this morning's topic, caveats, note the interests, beware the traps, is very aptly named. We have a well-qualified panel of speakers to address you this morning. On my immediate right here is William Stark, who has been a member of the Victorian Bar since 1998. He practices in a broad range of commercial disputes in the areas of property, especially mortgage-related property, contracts, corporations law and insolvency. And Bill also writes his own blog about property law related matters, and you'll find the reference to that on his bio, which is in the folder. William has appeared in a number of cases successfully opposing mortgagee sales and seeking the removal of caveats. He appears regularly at VCAT in retail tenancy and real property proceedings. And prior to his life at the bar, he was a solicitor at Hall & Wilcox and Mallesons, Stephen Jakes. Bill was also an accredited commercial litigation specialist with the Law Institute of Victoria before he came to the bar. Next to him, we have another Bill, Bill Rimmer, who's been a barrister now for a number of years and practices predominantly in property law, commercial law, wills and estates, equity and trusts. He was a solicitor at Blake Dawson Waldron from 1990 to 1996, and then he was in-house at ANZ Bank and had responsibility for the bank's property transactions. He also spent some time at Arthur Robinson and Hedwig's, now Allens Linklaters, where he was a senior associate in their property group. Bill also lectures in property law at the University of Melbourne and has done so in the JD, LLB and Masters course for about 10 years. Next is John Warren, who's been at the bar since 2008. John has a general commercial practice with an emphasis on property law. He deals extensively with commercial landlord and tenant disputes, matters where contracts for the sale of land have failed to complete, co-ownership disputes and adverse possession matters. He regularly appears in VCAT as well as all the Victorian courts. And prior to coming to the bar, John worked for the state government predominantly in the Crown Land Management Branch and the Department for Sustainability and Environment. So you'll see that we have a very experienced panel to address you this morning on this interesting topic. We're going to depart from the usual style this morning in that we are not going to have a series of semi-lectures. Instead, we're going to have a panel discussion, and we hope that it will be interactive. So I will be asking the panel questions, and we invite you at any stage to, you know, put your hand up and to ask questions while that question occurs to you. So I'm going to kick off this morning's session, firstly by asking Bill Rimmer to tell us when, Bill, should solicitors be lodging a caveat? And Bill's just turning on the microphone. Bill, perhaps I can give you mine.
Hello. Yes, it works. Thanks, Carol. I'll try and compete with this noise out in the courtyard behind me, which seems to be particularly loud this morning. But your question's really a very relevant one to solicitors, I think. There are really two aspects to the question, as I see it. First, there's the obvious legal question, which should be our prime concern as lawyers, which is whether the client who's presented in the conference to with the instructions is telling us that they have what amounts to a caveatable interest in law. But really the second question, and I think also important for practitioners, and you've touched on it a little bit in your opening, is the question, the strategic question of whether a caveat is useful in some way, but within appropriate limits that we're obviously going to explore today, in helping the resolution of the dispute, particularly in a way that protects your client's interests. So the first of those questions, if I can take a moment to explore them, is whether the client's presenting with a caveatable interest. A useful starting point from an analytical point of view, I find, is a case called Classic Heights and Black Hole Enterprises. Now, practitioners here, and I see a few, though not too many, who have been in practice for many, many years, will know that this case is not followed, and in fact sent a cold shiver of fear through property lawyers when it first came out. And I'm not going to pretend that it is any more expresses good law in Victoria, but it is still referred to in a number of cases. For example, the Chief Justice referred to it in case of Schmidt and 28 Myola Street as a classification of types of caveatable interests. And for that purpose, I think it's still a useful analytical tool. And in that case, the trial judge identified three categories of interests that could be caveated. So the first was where the caveator had an instrument which could be registered or recorded in the register and which, upon being recorded, would register an estate or interest as claimed by the caveat. So this is the classic case, if you like, that from a very early stage of the development of Torrens law has always been known to create an equitable interest in land, namely where you've settled on a transaction, paid the purchase price, and are holding a registrable instrument. That could be a transfer of land, could be a mortgage, but the essence of the transaction is that it's been completed, and therefore equity regards the instrument as already achieving that which in law it will achieve when it's registered.
And what are the other types of interest?
So the second one, which is also uncontroversial, is where there are equitable interests because you're entitled to call for a registrable interest, so instrument. So it's sort of going one step further back in the transaction. For example, a purchaser under a contract of sale, or someone who might have an entitlement to a constructive trust and be able to call for a transfer of the land. Those type of interests are also clearly caveatable. The third type, though, which have caused some concern and the usual ones which give rise to uncertainty in the cases, is where you've got an interest that arises purely from equitable principles. One of those types is, of course, the equitable charge. That's always been a caveatable interest, and it's still the case now that that's caveatable. Mm-hmm. But there's no end to the class of interest that could be created or could be caveated if you can bring yourself within equitable principles. I'm indebted to my colleague Bill Stark for having brought to my attention a case last month of Southage Petty Wealty Dean Beijing Garden Resort, in which Justice Vickery really considered four caveats, and it's really a very useful case on obviously a brief glance from me, because it considers a number of different caveatable interests and really shows how there are or what the principles are. One of the interests claimed was, for example, an interest under a discretionary trust. And this really illustrates the limits of what caveats can be used for because, as we all know, discretionary trusts, except in very, very exceptional circumstances, would not create proprietary interests for the benefit of beneficiaries. So a caveat can't be used in that circumstance. But solicitors might still think perhaps that for strategic considerations that they might lodge a caveat. Well, this case would show you that that's the type of situation where you really ought not to do that because that's not a caveatable interest. So that's the limits on these principles. Another limit that's well known, of course, arising from the case of Swanston Mortgage and Trepan Investments is where all your clients got is really a mere equity, which is an entitlement perhaps to have a transaction set aside, for example, many of the cases Bill has appeared in, where someone's challenging the exercise of power of sale by a mortgagee and claims that they've got an entitlement to have the contract of sale set aside because of a breach of duties, well, that doesn't give you a caveatable interest, because that's a mere equity. That's again an example of the limits, and shows you how the strategic use of caveats can't be pushed to the point where you claim an interest in someone's land when you really don't have the interest. Well, so that brings... Sorry.
So you mentioned at the outset that there was strategic considerations before you lodge a caveat. Can you tell us what some of those strategic considerations might be, Bill?
Yes, well, the most important thing about a caveat is that it is, as you mentioned in your opening, an administrative injunction. What it does is it stops the registrar from dealing with or from registering any dealings with the land. And from a strategic point of view, this is a very powerful right that the holder of an equitable interest has, because they can effectively obtain an injunction by paying a very small fee to the registrar without having to incur the costs of commencing proceedings to substantiate the interest, and without having to incur the cost of obtaining the injunction as an interlocutory step in those proceedings. So you save yourself, you know, thousands of dollars at the outset. So it's a very powerful tool to employ. But the it can be used, in other words, as a bargaining tool. If you have an entitlement to an equitable interest and you're in the middle of a dispute and you know that there is a risk of the property being sold from underneath your client, then one should really put a caveat on and should always consider that. But one can't divorce that from the first principles that I discussed, namely one must have the legal entitlement to do so, because the case of Goldstraw, which would be well known to everyone, decision of Justice Dodd Streeton, shows that clearly that a caveat can't be used solely as a bargaining tool. In that case, counsel actually got up and said to the court, well, we know we haven't got a caveatable interest, but you know, it's an important bargaining tool. It kept us at the bargaining table, and therefore it was right that we put the caveat on. And the judge, without being too critical of that, nevertheless made it quite clear that that's not a proper purpose of a caveat.
And Bill, do you think, is it your experience that there is widespread misuse of the caveatable procedure?
Well, I'm not sure that I'd say it was widespread, but there are certainly, because of the powerful bargaining tool that it actually is, there certainly are many cases that I've seen where someone has lodged a caveat purely for the purposes of applying pressure to someone and obtaining an advantage in a dispute, which really is not one where the property itself should properly be restricted in the hands of the registered proprietor. And it's those circumstances where I think it has been misused, yes.
So essentially what you're always looking for is to establish that you've got some interest in land.
That's always the bottom line, and it'll come out again, I'm sure, in further discussion of the procedures for removal, that's always the threshold question. It's not the only question, but it's the threshold question.
And do you think that because of that, of course, you know, if the caveat is lodged, in my example that I gave, a caveat wasn't lodged by a solicitor, but of course a solicitor who lodges a caveat has a responsibility to make sure that there is an interest in land or a proper caveatable interest. If they fail to do so, do you think that could give rise to some disciplinary action against the solicitor? What's your view about that?
Well, of course, the Legal Practice Act does have, or it might be the Legal Profession Act, I always get that title wrong. I'm sorry if I've got it wrong. The Act certainly imposes high standards on solicitors now, and the Legal Services Commissioner has proven itself to be, if perhaps slow, nevertheless an effective enforcer of those standards now. And yes, I am aware of a number of cases where either the court has referred the matter to the Legal Services Commissioner for further investigation, or another practitioner has done so, where a solicitor has simply lodged a caveat without there being any basis for it whatsoever. That, of course, there are other remedies under the Act if you do that as well. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bill. Now I'm going to go to John. John, do you have some comments about the misuse of caveat procedure? What's your experience?
Yes, certainly it seems to me that in the popular imagination, clients, even unsophisticated ones, often understand that a caveat is a powerful tool, and when they're owed money, I've had a number of clients say, yeah, can we put a caveat on their house? And obviously in the absence of something connecting the dispute to that actual property, no, you can't. But there's a pressure from clients, which no doubt many of you have experienced, to put a caveat on because it is so cheap and it is so powerful. As a consequence, there are some that get through and do get lodged that certainly should not be. In my recent experience, I had a matter where a caveat was lodged. A party felt wronged because of events that occurred about 25 or 30 years ago, and lodged a caveat alleging a constructive trust. And then we applied to have it removed under Section 89A, which I think Bill Stark will tell you more about shortly, which forced the caveator to issue proceedings. So they did commence proceedings, but they never served that proceeding on my client. And so the matter just sat there going nowhere. So fortunately, there was no need for my client to sell or anything like that. But the rule is, it's in Section 89A 7B, which I believe you have a copy of.
The is it worth going to that, John, to have a look at that?
I'll explain briefly. We won't spend too much time on it because it's a somewhat rare scenario. And so that action has to be discontinued or withdrawn or something along those lines for the registrar to be satisfied that therefore the caveat can come off. Now, where the proceeding has never even started, it's been filed but never served, then that was a very sneaky way of getting around this subsection and allowing the caveat to remain in place. So my client had to go to the Supreme Court, get a copy of the statement of claim from the file, call for a directions hearing, and then eventually we got going and settlement discussions resulted in its withdrawal. But that was a completely inappropriate caveat to lodge, not because a constructive trust is not a suitable reason for lodging, but because the facts in this particular case was an extremely weak allegation. And that was a clever tactic that was devised to have a caveat remain in place that should never have been there in the first place. So misuse certainly occurs.
Thanks, John. And Bill, I think the other day you told me about a recent case where proceedings had been issued but not served, and the question arose whether that was a an abusive process. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes, I appeared before Associate Justice Mukhtar in exactly the scenario that that John had, where the proceeding had been commenced, so it was on foot, and it was properly alerted to the or notified to the registrar that the proceeding was on foot, but the writ had never been served. There had been substantial discussions between the party solicitors, and this went on for a period of 2 or more years, and of course the writ was then stale. So you're in a stalemate situation procedurally, because the caveat stays on because the proceedings are on foot, but the proceeding, no step can be taken in it because they haven't been served within a year. So I went to Associate Justice Mukhtar on an application that this was an abusive process. As it turns out, Associate Justice Mukhtar didn't agree with me because he held that the real problem was in the act itself. This is something that Justice Hargrave had already alerted, had already made recommendations for law reform on in a case in 2005 called Dharmalingam and the Registrar of Titles. And Associate Justice Mukhtar was one step ahead of me. He'd read that case and, in fact, thought about it quite a bit since 2005 and already knew what his views were. The abuse was built into the Act. It wasn't an abuse of the processes of the court, so he held.
Because the Act doesn't require service.
It doesn't require service, and there's no doubt that's a problem with the Act. Yes. And John's obviously experienced exactly the same thing, where you start the proceeding but you don't serve it. Yes?
Can't you just simply enter
it? You're exactly right. That's exactly what now should be done. Yes, and obviously it's what John's client did because he said he listed it for a directions hearing. You couldn't do that unless you entered an appearance. But it really means that you're in a very strange situation where the defendant in the proceeding, having already made it quite clear that they require this to be put before the courts, also has to take the active step in the proceeding to bring it on, which is, well, it's unusual to say the least. But nevertheless, you're quite right. The solution is already there in the rules. When you get the notice from the registrar, if you really want this, put the pressure on the caveator and require them to get on and substantiate their claim, then you should take a copy of the writ from the court file and enter an appearance. That'll show them what's what.
Yeah. We'll take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll hear from Bill and the other members of the panel on how we remove caveats. But does anybody have any questions that arose out of the first part of the discussion this morning?
Arose out of what you said.
I might hand you.
Arising out of the issue of equitable interest and lodging of caveats, where you have a dispute over whether an easement or a right of passageway has arisen or not, I take it in the general course that if there is reasonable evidence to put forward to support such an an estoppel kind of argument, that that would give rise to a caveatable interest.
It most particularly, yes, because an easement is a property interest. As Bill will explain, the standard of evidence that you need to have is becoming increasingly an important consideration you have to take into account at the outset, but that is a different question. The first question is satisfied in that case. What the client's instructions are amounts to a caveatable interest, yes.
And I take it also at the end of the trial, if it turned out that the interest was hopeless and the caveat ought never to have been lodged, then the practitioner could be sanctioned for not having identified that sufficiently at the outset.
The answer to that, I think, lies in, it's really in a totally new body of law, which is the Civil Procedure Act. If you, in fact, at the end of the proceeding, it's shown that there was absolutely no basis on your instructions that you could have, that you could have commenced the proceeding, then yes, there may be cost consequences for you. as under the Civil Procedure Act. And also, if you were unfortunate enough, as one of my instructing solicitors was at one time, to come up against Justice Cairo when the proceeding is determined, on the scenario that you've given, he may well refer it himself to the Legal Services Commissioner. That comes as a great shock. But
well, of course, now under the Civil Procedure Act,
yes,
there has to be a proper basis certificate. So when proceedings, yes, are issued. So
of course, your mind is focused on it at a very, yeah, early point. Yeah. But
I think we had another question just before we break at the back of the room, Brett.
Russell Cox, in his conveyancing Bible, makes the comment that a caveat cannot be lodged in respect of a charge given by one only of, say, two joint proprietors, as distinct to ownership of tenants in common and one tenant in common. Now, I'm interested in the panel's comments on that, because it's commonly done, particularly in family court matters, where a caveat, a charge might be given by one of the participants to their solicitor to cover legal fees. So I'm interested in comments on that.
My view about that would be that you can charge your share of or your interest in the property, so the caveat would be sustainable over the chargee's interest in the property, sorry, the chargeor's interest in the property. So instead of lodging a caveat over the whole of the land, you're only lodging a caveat over that part of the land that has been charged by the chargeor. So you're not restricting use of the property by those owners that haven't charged their interest in the land.
I agree with that.
There's another short question here.
Does that sever the joint tenancy?
I might answer that. Yeah. No, it wouldn't sever the joint tenancy. Even mortgaging your interest as a joint proprietor doesn't sever the joint tenancy. Obviously, the sale by the, if it was done under court order, if it was a charge, or the sale by the mortgagee would, but not just the granting of the mortgage. But as Bill says, what you're really granting a mortgage over is a very nebulous interest. You're really over the charging the interest in the which is liable to or subject to the right of survivorship. So it might only last as long as the chargeor.
All right, well, look, I think we'll take a 10-minute break now and come back and we'll talk about removal of caveats.